This is the Emperor. You're listening to the Sci-Fi Diner Podcast.
Come grab a table, pull up a chair at the Sci-Fi Diner, where the food is always hot and your hosts are, well, out of this world. Sample some geeky trivia.
You, our listeners, need to tell us, what Star Trek series did Tony Amendola guest star in?
Dine with celebrity guests.
Hi, this is LeVar Burton from Roots, Star Trek The Next Generation.
This is Lori Holden from The Walking Dead.
And rub shoulders with the locals.
This is Floyd of Aurora, Colorado.
Hi, this is Rick from Montana.
And get it to go with the Sci-Fi 5 and 5.
Top 5 movies, one scene, cannot be unseen.
All served up at SciFiDinerPodcast.com. Serving up science fiction from here to the end of the universe.
Hey everybody, this is Sammy Cat. You might know me as the Witty Knitter, but right now, you're listening to Chance with Timmy D Express. Praise be.
Hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener. And welcome to episode 28 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things you can find on iTunes or your fancy podcast apps. You can also find the Dan and Travis Show and this show right here over at the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that's attempting to find the culture in pop culture over at chronicrift.com. I want to thank everybody for retweeting and sharing and downloading and listening and spreading the word about last week's episode with John Matthews and his really fantastic Kickstarter. There's still time to contribute and donate. You know, there's a lot of great independent movies and a lot of fantastic projects. If you're kind of tired of what you're seeing on the main marquee at your movie theater or just some of the mainstream stuff, there's some fantastic, wonderful independent cinema out there that you could find. It's actually turning into a golden age for all that kind of stuff, which we're going to be talking about a lot more over the next coming weeks because I have a lot more independent filmmakers and even independent TV makers lined up to be on the show. And also my guest today is involved in some of the world of independent cinema as well. But she also is what they call, she's an editor, and I've worked with a lot of editors over the years, and it's a fascinating aspect of the entertainment business, and one that I think is kind of misunderstood. I think everybody knows what an editor does, but I don't think they necessarily always understand how an editor does it. And there's a lot of aspects to the post-production world that we're going to talk about today, including a bunch of other fascinating topics, because my guest today is just one of the most fascinating people you could ever hope to meet. Welcome to the Handsome Timmy D Express, Crystal House.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Crystal.
I know. We don't do it enough.
I know. It's sad. Well, we're working. We're too busy making cool stuff.
Yeah.
So we have to schedule podcasts to catch up. So, well, actually, your main vocation right now, I believe, is you're an online editor.
Yes, I do mostly online editing and color correction.
Now, as we were talking about before we started recording, I think that the process of online and post-production is possibly the thing in the entertainment business and production that the general public knows the least about.
Yeah, I didn't even know what online editing was until after college. So,
I didn't really understand it until I actually got into post-production, and even then there was a couple of like, oh, that's what it is. So how would you explain the process of offline and online editing?
I do a lot of reality shows, and I mean, really anything. When you're dealing with a ton of footage, you want to bring it in at a low resolution because there's just so much of it that you can't physically, the machines won't handle all this high-res footage to edit with. So most editors work with like a lower resolution footage, which looks kind of crappy. And then once the cut is put together, the pieces that they've chosen to edit with, those get brought in at the high resolution so you can finally see what the product actually looks like. And at that stage, it goes over to another editor who pretty much makes it look pretty, fixes the color mistakes or adds a feel for color, puts the graphics in where they belong. There's a lot of rules, especially for broadcast television, and you have to make sure that all those rules are being followed. Mm-hmm. And it's just hard to really see those things in the lower resolution.
I think the online mix and what you're talking about making it pretty is a remarkably painstaking process.
It can be, especially when you're dealing with different types of formats and cameras that aren't white balanced, and you don't really know until it's in that final stage what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm. Now, what makes when you you've done just regular? I'm trying to think of the phrase here. I don't want to say just regular editing, but you know just full time offline content editor for shows. And you've done online editing for shows. Is there a big transition there? Like, did you decide one day, hey, I'd really like to do online. That's much more of my skill set is more based there. Or was it literally just the pragmatic nature of the freelance world and finding gigs where you can get them?
It was. I've never been very comfortable with the newer style of editing. It was never something I was really strong at, the whole, like, docudrama, edit every 2 seconds kind of feel. But I still love post-production and I wanted to stay in that as my day job. So I kind of went into online. I went from assistant editing to online because it allowed me to still do the things I was good at, but not feel like I had to kind of change my editing style to conform with what's popular now in television.
Is it fair to say, it's an interesting answer. Is it fair to say, and maybe I'm wrong and maybe this is completely unfair, that, like, when you're doing online editing, you're still in much more of a visual medium of editing, because before it gets to online, there's a lot of, you know, and that's where I mostly worked. I've actually, been to online a handful of times in my life, but I've spent the majority of my career with the editors creating the story, creating the content, doing much more of a narrative type structure. So is it almost fair to say that online is more of like a visual location? And okay, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I mean, I barely even watch the show as it is with audio until my very last pass on it. Because it is about just the visual aspects of it. I mean, someone else is doing the mix, so I have to check to make sure, like, the sync matches with the audio and things like that, especially in reality TV cheats where they'll try to get someone to say something they aren't really saying. You know, I have to make sure that looks good. So I deal with the audio and making sure things flow smoothly a little bit, but it's pretty much just about the picture itself at that point.
Audio cheats? I know. I have no idea what you're talking about. What's a frank fight?
I don't even know.
But also sometimes, though, when it comes to some of those cheats before people, you know, for more about this, you can check out the episode we did with story producer Roy LaPointe. But sometimes those Frankenbites before people are thinking, oh my God, they're deflating footballs. Sometimes that is literally just piecing two pieces of a sentence together to add clarity.
Yeah, it's about trying to get to the core of what the person's saying without all the ums and the errs and the misstarts, just to get the quickest possible way to say it.
I know. If you read, like, a court transcript, which is always my favorite, or, like, quotes, you know, if you ever see clean quotes on a TV, you'll see, or even here, like me, I always have to, like, start and stop sentences. It's never clean. Like, nobody talks in proper grammar or anything. But it's weird how on unscripted shows, all that stuff goes away and everybody speaks perfectly. So that's people like me and Crystal making that happen.
Yeah. I did transcription for a while, and you don't realize how much you filter out just when you're listening as, like, a regular person, when you have to actually type out exactly what someone's saying, it's all over the place.
Well, you know, and pulling the curtain back on this thing, the first few episodes I listened to, it, I was like, oh, gee, should I edit out some of those questions that I really sort of fumble with? And I'm kind of like, I don't even know what the hell I'm asking. I'm trying to find the words, you know? And then I'm like, oh, first of all, it's way too much work. And second of all, what do I care? I'm thinking out loud here, folks. I'm just making it all up as I go along, and I just want to have a cool conversation. So what do I care if I bumble through a sentence or two? Maybe I'm burnt out on that from reality TV. So let me ask you this. Now, you've done you started off in post-production and transcribing stuff. It's funny. If you go to, like, a film school or you talk to people about, like, what they want to do in the business, a lot of times people say, I want to be a director. I want to be a filmmaker. Not a lot of people say, I want to be an editor, and yet a lot of people who, if you talk to a lot of editors, a lot of them study directing, study filmmaking, but found a real love and a real creative force within the world of editing. What made you decide to get into post-production and editing?
When I got to film school, I had no idea about anything. You had to take all the various classes. I thought I maybe wanted to be a cinematographer or a director. I mean, that was what was popular when I was in film school. And then I took an editing class, and we had to edit this gun smoke footage. It was ridiculous. But my professor at the time, Joe Dull, who's amazing, he had said I did something in that scene that he hadn't seen before and that he really enjoyed it. And that was, he'd seen that scene, hundreds of times with different students. And just him giving me that compliment that I'd done something different made me realize, like, this is what I'm good at. I'm really good with computers. I'm good with finding story in footage and moments. And I knew, like, from freshman year that I wanted to be an editor. And that's all I focused on throughout film school.
I also just want to point out real quick, if anybody hears any like birds chirping or anything background, Crystal is our very first outdoor guest on the podcast. Actually, no, wait, Sammy was out for a little bit, but not the whole show. This is Southern.
Can move.
That's Southern California ambiance for you. I think that's an interesting thing to go from cinematography to editing. I don't actually hear that a lot.
I mean, this is in like freshman year. I had no idea. I just knew I wanted to make movies for a living.
But but you were also talking about the visual style of online. Did that sort of, it sounds like your interest in art, artisticness and visual stimulation never really went away.
I think I've just realized for myself that I'm a natural editor. Like, that's my personality. Like, I can read a screenplay and edit it and make suggestions. I never felt like I had a story to tell specifically, but that I was good at making other people's stories better and translating that to the audience. I think it's a really valuable skill.
One thing I kind of learned in working with editors is that sometimes they're seen as like, if you watch like some DVDs and see some special features, they'll portray like Terry Rawlings as the most heartless guy in Hollywood or whatever. And like, they'll just cut any great scene and everything and they'll cut all this stuff. And it's actually not true. They're very far from that. And they're actually, part of their job is to cut to make something prettier.
Yeah. Or just to sometimes the director is trying to tell something or the writer and they're just, in their mind, it makes sense, but I have to make it make sense to the people watching it. And sometimes that is cutting something out that the director thinks is important, but generally it's just trying to make it more clear and more interesting for the audience.
Let's talk nuts and bolts for a second. And without like shit canning anybody you've worked with. But there is that sense of like, tell me a scenario like this, whether it be a film director or a producer, like you as an editor know the scene has to flow a certain way. And then the producer or director walks in the room and says, no, I want to take it this other way.
A lot of times the best thing, and this is the problem with digital editing, is that you can make all kinds of changes instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
The director wants to see it or the producer wants to see it all these different ways. And you know, as an editor, like which way it actually works based on the performance, based on the technical stuff. But sometimes you have to cut it the other way so they can see that it doesn't work that way. And there's things that I'll fight for and there's things that I'll let go depending on how important it is to me. And I did want to say, though, that what you said about, like, people want to be directors and that sort of thing, I think editing has become super popular lately. Like, kids want to be editors now because of YouTube and because of all this digital stuff.
You know, that's absolutely right, and that's a good point because we now have, I mean, like, I'm going to age myself here, but, I mean, it is sad. Like, when I was at Emerson, and shame on them, in the late 90s, I believe there was one Avid that the master's class could use. And I think maybe even the graduate students. Like there was rumors when I was at Emerson that there was an Avid on campus. And we were doing Steenbeck flat editing. I mean, the art of editing was an almost inaccessible craft and medium. And nowadays, you're right. Like kids can, like a 10-year-old who wants to play with some footage can do it and doesn't even realize they're like, quote-unquote, editing.
Yeah, people do it on their phones, and I mean, it's easy, and it's cool, and it's fun now, where before it was really technical and really hard to work with. I didn't do flatbed, but we had a program called Discrete Logic Edit that I started on, which doesn't exist anymore, and it was so difficult to use.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive. But
make no offense to discrete logic edit.
But at the same time, though, if you make a Vine video, if you make like 200 Vine videos, I would argue that you're going to learn some basics and the rudimentary skill set of editing. But and it's like I'm trying to like demystify it here, but not too much, because like, I mean, I've worked with good editors and I've worked with not good editors. You know what I mean? And there is a difference. It's not like, you know, the point I'm trying to get at for the listener is that editing is not taking two pictures and putting them together. It's taking the right two pictures that put them together, that create a story that makes sense, that's pretty, that's flow, and in which the cuts in many ways are invisible.
Yeah. I mean, there's things that I focus on that I know no one sees, like eye movement. I mean, they see it, but they don't consciously see it. Like right. The way the person's looking at another person and just little minor things. There's like a million things to focus on, and every cut should be motivated and there for a reason.
No, absolutely right. Now, you've done online, but you've also done offline and quote-unquote regular narrative editing for an independent feature?
Yes, it's called Stand, and we just kind of finished that up recently.
So what's that been like to go from
That was very offline? Interesting. We shot, or they shot, I should say, in the jungles in Taiwan. So the actors are actually in the jungle for most of the film, and they couldn't even really hear each other while they were talking. So, and the director didn't have, I mean, how do I say this? It was a different kind of film because yeah. It really was just kind of done in the middle of nowhere, on a very low budget without all the like, all the things that you would normally have on a big budget film to make sure that all the shots are going together correctly.
Now, I would imagine on a shoot like that or a production like that, the editing is going to become very important because that sounds like a pretty guerrilla style environment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to. The people working on it were very professional, and it was a very well done shoot, but it was definitely a small shoot. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to use the word guerrilla because I feel like that's. Not giving the crew enough credit, but it definitely was small and it was the first feature for the director and, it was a learning experience for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, shooting in a jungle is tough. I mean, yeah, on Predator, which is, you know, buco bucks and millions of dollars, John McTiernan like broke his wrist.
Yeah.
So anytime you enter, I don't mean to, oh no, I'm not, I wouldn't want to run any, I mean, I don't think I'd want to shoot in the jungle. So I give him a ton of credit for doing that, but it's anytime you enter a hostile environment for a film, like your sort of production schedule and a lot of the things that you try to organize can sometimes just get thrown out just because of the nature of the environment.
Well, it was raining a whole lot too. So that's a whole other thing.
Exactly. So is that the type of situation where you're like, okay, wow, here we go. You know, like this is like you roll your sleeves up, you rub your hands, you're like, this is it. Let's rock and roll.
Yeah, I mean, the film, too, is mostly dialogue. Like, it's a present-day two American brothers that end up trapped on a landmine field in the middle of the jungle. So it's mostly dialogue. There's not a whole lot. There's some action moments, but it really is about the story between these two brothers stuck out there, not sure if they're going to be rescued or not. And that's a challenge as an editor to make that interesting because it is mostly talking. You don't have a lot of things you can cut to. We didn't cut away from the two actors. Mm. It was just on them for most of the film.
The something I think editors create more than they get credit for is, and I've heard, and I think directors get credit for this too, but I think editors can really bring it out. Like the director may decide on it, but the editor is the one that makes it happen. And that's the pacing of the film.
Oh yeah.
Or the piece. And can you talk about that for a second, how important that is? And because you talked about before, like, how you don't like cutting every 2 seconds, and sometimes it's that in modern editing. Talk about that, because I think that's interesting for an editor to say, no, hey, let's sit on the shot a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I want to, like, I love showcasing beautiful cinematography and beautiful scenes, and you don't get to really appreciate that when you're just cutting it up the whole time. And I think that, you know, we've all seen those action or those horror movies where they try to have the tension and everything's happening all the time, and you need to have some kind of contrast between, you know, let yourself relax a little so you can get scared again or so you can get tense again. And if you're just trying to maintain one level of tension, you don't, you don't get as involved in what's going on. It's about creating, you know, contrasting moments so that they mean more, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. It makes a ton of sense. Especially because, I mean, that's why I think, and I don't want to knock, there's some great modern day horror movies out there, and we did a whole episode on that, the episode with Rick Dominicus. But I do think sometimes, I prefer a lot of movies from the 70s myself.
Oh, me too. And that's like the editing style that I love is yeah. Films like Paris, Texas, and just, just beautiful and the seamless editing. And when there's edits that it means something and that why, if an actor's giving a great performance, stay on that actor, you don't have to cut away. That's the editing that I really enjoy. And I feel like is being lost a little bit in modern cinema.
Do you think, well, it sounds like you see editing as quite frankly, a part of the overall piece as opposed to, yeah, because I've ran into this a lot, not a lot, but a fair amount with some people and some folks in reality TV who will remain nameless who are like, I would always hate it when an editor would say, all right, I'm going to start cutting now the real work begins. Like,
oh.
You know what I mean? Like, I kind of roll my eyes a bit of like, and I've worked with some guys who are like, I'm saving this whole thing with my, you know, and I think they sometimes forget they're. We're all part of a larger piece. Screenwriters, editors, we're all one part of a team, you know?
Yeah, and I think editing is it's about making things better and that you can do some amazing creative things with editing, but if it doesn't work with everything else that's going on, then it's going to be weird and it's not going to make a better film. It's just going to be a distracting montage or something.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about editing and post-production, be it reality TV or filmmaking or both?
Oh, well, I mean, reality and film are two totally different things. I mean, everyone thinks reality is scripted, which it's scripted after the fact, I guess.
Like that's a great way to put it.
It is. Like, it's you shoot just hours and hours and hours, and then you try to find the story. Where in film, you have the story, and you're trying to shoot based on that story. But real life doesn't work like that. So I think people think that, I mean, I worked on Jersey Shore, and there was a lot of controversy about, like, well, JWoww's sock is off in this scene, and it's on in this scene, or whatever. And they think that the editor's trying to cheat something. And it's like, well, no, in reality, that fight or whatever was, like, 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Like, you can't...
and the sock came off.
People. I can't show every, you know, you can't show when the sock came off because no one, that's not important to the story. You have to condense this 3 hour thing that happened into 3 minutes. So you're going to miss some little details like that, but it's not like, you know, you're cheating it or that it's false. It's just that what's the most interesting thing that happened in that 3 hours and the sock coming off is not going to be it.
Well, I'll tell you right now, let's hope not. I've worked on some shows, Crystal, where the sock coming off is like, oh my God, thank goodness the sock came off. I think too, I always love that stuff. It's like, they're trying to trick us. It's like, look, if you're watching the show, we've tricked you and we've won. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the trick.
We've sold the advertising for this. You're watching it.
It is absolutely done. I think we talked about this, Rory, you know, the Big Brother did a great one where, there was a 40-minute fight in the live online feed, and then the time it got to the show, it was about 2 minutes for the live feed. But you didn't miss anything, and you could have seen both and compared and contrast. And that actually is a great example, I think, of what you just described, which is, you know, if you get the spirit of the story and the spirit of what the characters are doing, and then you can create the scene, and there's your story. Do you find, because I've had this situation a lot in a show where we're like, a continuity, like, have you run into that a lot where if there's a continuity error or something that maybe the picture isn't quite as pretty as some of the other ones, but if it moves the story along in the best way possible, you sometimes have to make that sacrifice.
I had an editing professor that said, if there's a Coke can in the background in some shots and it's not there in other shots, I mean, that's a huge continuity mistake. And as an editor, you try to minimize those. But if your audience is noticing that a Coke can is disappearing and reappearing in the background, then you have bigger problems with your story than that Coke can.
Absolutely. Amen.
Like, I mean, in Star Wars, that trooper that hits his head, falls down. You've seen that scene?
No. I've seen it like 50 times, of course.
It's amazing. And there's all these stormtroopers running, and some actor hits his head and falls down. And it's hilarious. But you never, ever, ever see that because you're so involved in the story that little things like that, continuity things, are secondary. But if it's a slow scene or if you're not engaging the audience, then they're going to start noticing continuity errors.
If anybody thinks we're full of shit by saying this, I just want to point out, I would direct you to go watch The Fugitive. And go watch The Fugitive, the scene specifically where Tommy Lee Jones and his crew are catching up to Richard Kimball. And they get to him in, they don't get to him, but they're on his trail, and they get to the hospital. And this is after Kimball has figured out who the one-armed man is, I believe. And now they're in the hospital in the prosthetics wing. Tommy Lee Jones is sitting with his crew trying to narrow down who the one-armed man might be. Tommy Lee Jones's scarf is flying around his neck. He's holding a prosthetic. He's not holding a prosthetic. The continuity is out the window on that scene. And I've seen The Fugitive about 50 times. I have it on both Laserdisc and DVD. I don't even know how many times I had to watch that show before I noticed it. And I was like, holy son of a bitch. Like, and I'm a trained eye. Like, I think it's one of those things where people, I don't know, I think people should feel quite clever for pointing out some of those things and noticing some of that stuff. In the long run, it kind of doesn't really matter.
Yeah. And I think people ask me a lot, like, if I watch films and I'm not able to enjoy them because I'm just looking at the editing. And I am hardly ever looking at the editing.
Right.
I mean, I'm not looking and getting ideas or figuring it out or trying to find continuity errors. If the movie's good, I'm just watching a movie and my disbelief is suspended and I'm into it and I love it. It's if the movie's boring, then I'm going to start picking it apart for sure.
I can hear Frankenbite. You know, we'll be watching TV. And I'll totally hear a Frankenbite. And sometimes Megan won't, or whoever I'm watching TV won't. So I find that. I got to ask you about, did you see Birdman?
I did see Birdman.
What did you think of that?
I think people keep saying that it's trying to look like one shot.
I didn't notice that at all. I'm like, it was?
I mean, what it was amazingly clever transitions to get one period of time to another, in that you're in the same space, but it moves you forward in the story. And I thought that was, I thought that was incredible. I think it's being labeled incorrectly as trying to do a one shot or a one-er, but it's not. It's just amazingly clever transitions, and it moves you through the film just beautifully. Keeps you in that space and keeps you feeling like you're in a play and you're in those. You're not watching a movie. I really enjoyed that a lot.
Because I also feel, would you agree as an editor that if he did have had cuts, it would almost be distracting and it might actually take you out of the scene?
I mean, the story could have been done either way, I think. But I think that gave it the feel that it was trying to convey as like a small period of time in this person's life, even though it did move forward in time.
Right.
There were edits to get you farther in that time frame. I think that story would have been completely different had there been edits in it. Yes.
Copy that. I think the most misused word I've heard a lot is what they call a jump cut.
Yeah.
And I hear a lot of people say, oh, this is a jump cut. That's a jump cut. No, it's really not. It's just almost, sometimes it's just a cut that doesn't work.
Yeah, sometimes it's just bad editing. Jump cuts it's a tool. It should mean, again, every cut should be motivated. If you're making a jump cut, you should be making a jump cut.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be accidental continuity leaps or whatever you want to call it.
What do you think, now when you were editing, it's called Stand, the independent film.
Yes.
When you were editing Stand, was this a situation where you talked about, and we talk a lot about screenwriting on this podcast, this is primarily a screenplay podcast. How was the editing process on a scripted feature? Were you given the script and that was sort of a guide, or was it you and the director in the bay going over the story. How did that work?
Well, the director has a huge respect for the editing process. He told me the story on Silence of the Lambs, I guess that last scene where they're intercutting between Clarice, or she's in one location and they go to the other location.
Yep, that was all editing, yeah.
Yeah, and that I guess that the footage had been, I don't know how true the story is, but had all been mixed together incorrectly in the system, and the editor thought it was supposed to look like they were going to the right place, the right house, and then the reveal at the end that they aren't. And I guess originally it was supposed to take place or in two different scenes, and then you lose a lot of that tension. So he really wanted me to kind of go through and do it the way I felt that it should be done without his guidance and without, I mean, I had the screenplay, but he wanted me to use the footage and just put it together the way I felt worked, which is actually extremely difficult. I mean, you want to do what the director is trying to do, and you want to create accidental amazing moments, but that's not always possible, I guess. But I did my first pass without the director just to see, you know, how he felt about it. And then there were things that he liked that were not the way he had originally intended. And there were things that he preferred I go back to the way that he had wanted it to be. So it was basically coming together after I'd put together a cut and then figuring out what worked and what didn't and working together to decide the best way for the film to come together.
It's so funny. I could almost say the exact same thing for my first nose pass I just got from a director I'm working with right now. He said almost that phrase of like, no, I want this back in. Some of that works. I like you out of this, but no, I want to put some more of this stuff in now. But again, when you were piecing the movie together, like I'm assuming now, did you make, like, were you the one that made the rough cut and then all the way down to final cut?
Yeah, we had another editor come in at the end because we were a little long and there were some things. And we were at that point so married to the cut that we had that we needed someone to come in who hadn't read the screenplay or anything and make some cuts that were difficult for us to make at the time. And I'm so glad that editor came in because I was very reluctant to give away my baby. At that point, I felt like I had created, you know, this, like, given my heart and soul to this project, and I didn't want anyone else to touch it. And this editor came in, and he cut some scenes out, and he rearranged some stuff. But he left, like, what I was trying to do and the editing that I was trying to create and the moments that were really important to me. And he ended up making the film better. It was shorter. It flowed better. But sometimes you need somebody who doesn't know anything about what it was supposed to be to come in and make those decisions.
Well, he basically script doctored you, which happens all the time in the world of screenplays. And sometimes we actually, as screenwriters, will ask other writers to do that for us. Of like, hey, I'm 5 pages too long. Help me out. Where do I cut it?
Sometimes you have to kill your babies because they don't work as well as you think they do to other people. And sometimes the editor gets in that headspace too. Like the writer doesn't want to give stuff up. The director doesn't want to give stuff up. The editor doesn't want to give stuff up. And you have to have a person come in and be like, this, you have to get rid of this.
I like the way you put it. There's too close to it. Because sometimes you can't, that happens on every show. I think on every show, every production, every script, everywhere, you can't see the forest for the trees. I don't think there's a filmmaker, an artist on the planet who's immune to that.
No, and that's why a lot of, you know, people say you shouldn't edit your own films and it's just so much of you, and filmmaking should be about what it gives to the audience as well. And if the audience isn't responding or getting it, or you're not conveying yourself clearly, then it just becomes a project only for yourself. And that's not the point of filmmaking.
And again, did you have the script with you when you were making the rough cuts or not? Or was it,
I did. I referred to it, but I mean, things have changed from the original script to the shooting and what they were able to do. I mean, the rain, there were moments in the screenplay that really relied about them not having water,
and then it rains.
Had water, so you know,
that's a good note.
Stuff that no longer made a lot of sense. Sure. I mean, we still brought in how they trap the water to drink it because rain isn't enough. But, you know, things change and you have to adapt. Nothing no screenplay looks exactly like the film that it was shot. I mean, I'm sure there's one somewhere, but things that look good on paper may not look good on film.
No, absolutely. Is that, what would you say, though, to screenwriters who are listening, if anything? Like, is there anything that they could learn or from the editing process? And I know that, like, we're always taught to cut our screenplays and cut our screenplays, but, like, would you recommend some, like, I think it would be a great idea, quite frankly, for screenwriters to know and be a bit more, everyone always talks about, well, you should go shoot, but if you can't shoot, find a way to edit. You know what I mean? What would you say to screenwriters about the world of editing that you think would be useful to them as they write their screenplays?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the things is like just imagining without the words, because words are so important to screenwriters, and a lot of times they're telling instead of showing the action or what's going on. And just to try to visualize, are you still telling what you're trying to be telling, but only visually, without the words? And, I mean, obviously the words are very important, but when it comes to actually getting it on film and looking at it, you want that action to be there in the visual, in the film. You want to be able to watch what's going on and not just hear it. And when you're on the page, a lot of it is just about the words.
Right. No, that's true. That's great.
It's just a lot of, you know, how can I minimize this dialogue through action, I guess. I mean, not that you want to get rid of all the dialogue, but it is a visual medium, and you need to make sure you're keeping that in mind, I guess.
Yeah, especially because, like, I mean, I overwrite, and I don't mind admitting that, and I think that it's a good idea. Like if you have a first draft screenwriters out there that's 150 pages, that's okay. Don't panic. You know? But because sometimes you want to see five different ways the character may say, you know, no, I'm not going to give up. You know, and sometimes you need to see those five ways and act them out and try them out and write them. I think I would always say it's a good idea for screenwriters to write those words, but it's also a really good idea to not be afraid to lose them and to be able to pick the best and pick the most most effective and things like that. So we're coming close to our window here because we're on a clock. But before we jump off, I have to ask you, when you hand out your business card, it doesn't just say online editor. And I love talking about other things but outside of the world of filmmaking and screenwriting and stuff. You are, I think, the only ufologist that I actually know.
Well, I haven't completed my degree in ufology, but I am studying ufology.
That just brought up five more questions. Okay. So, tell me about this. This is a real. Now, I'm fascinated by all this stuff. I don't necessarily. I'm not a truther by any stretch. In fact, I hate the word truther. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think most of them fall apart. But I'm not necessarily a believer. But I'm fascinated by so much of this stuff and the exploration of the unknown. Tell us about the world of ufology and what it takes to actually become an accredited ufologist with a degree.
You're never going to be an accredited ufologist.
Accredited, but you know what I mean. Like, what's the? I don't know the right. I'm stumbling for the right word here.
I guess respected in the field is the best you can hope for. But
okay. Hey, that's a great thing to ask for.
I've looked into it. I mean, there are several different like online ufology schools, and there was only one that really felt like it was actually teaching you something. You weren't just paying to have a piece of paper.
Right.
But I think that, like, I mean, even people study mythology and get degrees in mythology, and there's such a history of UFOs and the culture and the sightings. I mean, there's just a giant wealth of information that's worth studying, and not just like chasing down UFOs in the field, but just like learning about the history of these sightings. And I mean, it dates back to ancient Indian texts and it's such a huge part of our culture. And it's worth studying and looking into. And I've never seen a UFO. I don't know if they exist. I mean, I don't know if aliens exist or what these UFOs are that people are seeing, but I think the whole thing is very fascinating.
Do you have to deal with, like, you know, because you don't strike me as very shy, but do you have to deal with, when you talk about this particular interest, a lot of eye rolling and people going, oh my God, here's a crazy person?
Oh, sure. And I've certainly rolled my eyes at some stories that I've read. And then by the end, I'm like, wow, that I have no explanation for that. I mean, I have a disorder called awareness during sleep paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I've told people this and they think I'm crazy. A lot of people think I'm crazy. But it's, I mean, it's a fairly common thing. When everyone is sleeping, your brain kind of disconnects from your body so that you don't act out your dreams. If you're dreaming that you're running, you don't get out of bed and start running. And certain people will wake up during this phase of sleep and their brain is wide awake, but they have no connection to their body. So you wake up and you feel like you can't move, but you can still see the room around you. And you feel like you can't breathe because your breathing's on autopilot, so you have no control over it. And the weird thing that happens during this state to a lot of people is that we see shadowy figures watching us sleep.
Hmm.
And this dates back to the term nightmare was used to describe old hag syndrome, which is what this is, where they thought a witch came through their window and sat on their chest and strangled them. It's also incubus, succubus. This all ties into this sleep disorder. But what I don't understand or what hasn't been explained to me is why we all see these figures watching us sleep. I've interacted with them. I've had the old hag sit on my chest and try to strangle me.
Wow.
And it's terrifying. It's the scariest thing that's ever happened to me. But I always snap out of it and wake up at a certain point. And it's not a dream. I'm wide awake, but it's certainly weird. And I think that it could be people have this disorder also feel like they're being abducted. You feel like you're being sucked out of your body. It's my only paranormal thing that has happened to me. And
well, is that paranormal or is it medical? I mean, everything you just said is there's a lot of science behind what you just talked about.
There's, of course.
You know what I mean?
Behind it, but it doesn't explain like the person I saw leave my dorm room bathroom and look at me like he was super annoyed and then walk out the front door. And it doesn't explain like the conversation I've had with some of these shadowy figures. Why don't people hallucinate bears or like butterflies? I mean, why is it always these same hallucinations if they are hallucinations? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
I wish I could find out. I wish I knew.
I wish I knew too.
I'm not trying to be glib, but
no. And I think some people that maybe thought they were abducted just have this experience happen to them.
I'm very dubious of alien abduction, and I think that's a good explanation as any.
There's a weird story about this guy in Australia, and I was like, this is the most fake thing ever. Where he dreamed he woke up and this alien's on his bed, and she was with a hybrid alien woman with blonde hair. And that woman ended up biting his penis, I think. It was a whole weird thing. And he woke up the next morning and there was a blonde hair wrapped around his penis. And they had it analyzed and the hair was, it was just like some kind of hair that shouldn't exist in reality. It hadn't been processed, but it was from someone of Asian descent that shouldn't have blonde hair. It was all very weird. And there's like this weird science that can't explain the blonde hair, even though his story is the craziest thing I've ever heard. But where did the hair come from? I don't know.
It's a fascinating thing out there. I saw a special years ago, and I think it's on YouTube. I'm going to try to find it, of a guy recreating alien abductions with a sleep experiment in Montreal.
Oh, okay.
And that tells me that your explanation for this... can you say it again? The paralysis disorder is called...
It's awareness during sleep paralysis.
During sleep paralysis.
Also called old hag syndrome.
Old hag syndrome. See, I hate that story of the gentleman in Australia with the unfortunate penis. I don't know if I would leap forward and say that's an alien, but at the same time, I think you bring up a good point, which is, well, what is this hair? What is this evidence? Where did it come from? How has this happened?
Yeah.
And I think there's so many crazy, like, I love crazy stories, and I love that stuff, and I hear this stuff, and I hear sometimes skeptics, quote-unquote, and non-believers, quote-unquote, who are like, oh, well, that's just a crazy story. Forget about it. And I'm like, no, I want to know where that hair came from, whether it be aliens or whether it be a Singapore prostitute he forgot about on a business trip. That's either way, I'm happy with that answer. Either one of those is a payoff.
I mean, the biggest problem, though, with studying this stuff is that there aren't, you know, a lot of people believe that there's just scientists out there doing science for fun. But every study and everything that scientists are doing right now has to have funding. And no one's willing to fund something that doesn't make a profit. And studying UFOs is not going to make a profit.
Well, why studying UFOs? I think it's very important now, and this is very serious. We're talking about the blonde hairs and penises, but this is a very important point in that there's the phenomenon of earth lights, and fortunately they're now changing it to be called earthquake lights, because what people figured out was in Mexico there were thousands of UFOs videotaped. Thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Before one of the major volcanoes, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce it, but and if I find out, I'll put the link below. And I don't want to try to pronounce it because it'll sound like I'm being offensive. But this is not a hoax. This is not a something that is denied. There is videotape footage of thousands upon thousands of lights in the sky in Mexico, and it took place before a volcano. And fortunately, some rather clever scientists turned around and said, hey, wait a second. And they started investigating other volcanoes, other earthquakes, and found that in certain regions of the world, before an earthquake and before volcanoes, a series of lights were seen in the skies. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that aliens and ETs are coming down and creating earthquakes. But many of these scientists turned around and said, hey, wait a second. Is there something happening with these tectonic forces that's releasing an energy that's manifesting itself as lights in the sky, or lights rising from the earth and into the sky? If that's true, and this is why they're calling them earthquake lights, that could be invaluable to regions like Southern California and the rest of the entire planet Earth, which currently has no earthquake warning system whatsoever.
Sure, but where's the profit in that is the thing.
Exactly, and that's what's terrible. And we're exactly. Well, fortunately, the profit would be in not having to rebuild cities.
No, but that's huge money right there. Right. That makes a lot of people money having to rebuild cities. I mean, this is a bigger thing. But I mean, then there's this mass UFO sightings, Phoenix Lights that happened a few years ago.
Oh yeah, there's no denying that it was on CNN.
Yeah.
And you know what's? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, there was one in upstate New York that police officers saw. I mean, it kept happening. People pulled over on the freeway. And there's no real solid explanation for these things. And I think the ones where many people saw this are really interesting. Someone has to explain this at some point.
The craziest thing about it, too, and it's funny, Crystal and I are old Doctor Who fans. And what's remarkable about the world of Doctor Who is that Doctor Who sees, in the world of Doctor Who, there's countless alien encounters and countless encounters by the human race with strange phenomenon that's quickly forgotten about within a year or two. And it sounds crazy, and you're watching it going, well, how could people forget about the Christmas spaceship? And I literally was talking to somebody a week ago about the Phoenix Lights on CNN, and they're like, I don't remember that. I'm like, how could you not remember the Phoenix Lights? It was all over in 1997 for like – it was live. It was breaking news. It was like, we don't know what these lights are. Live on – just like signs.
I lived in Phoenix at the time too. It was I was too young to be able to drive out there and see it, but – I mean, it really happened. I forget the official explanation, but it didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, what's funny is the governor came out the next day and said it was military testing or something like that.
Yeah.
He went to the military and said, okay, what were you guys doing? And they wouldn't tell him. And he has now become a proponent, and he is now somebody who's out there privately very much now that he's not governor anymore. And he's like, I want to know what happened because they're not telling me.
Yeah. I know. I feel like the simplest explanation for UFOs is the whole multiverse theory, that our universe is right on top of another universe, and that that other universe has figured out a way to travel in between. Because, I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that aliens are traveling millions of space miles to come and look at Earth. But it does make sense that a universe on top of ours would have an interest in our universe and want to see what's going on there.
I know. I was just talking multiverse with somebody the other day about like how that's the new thing. That's the new frontier. The most fascinating UFO thing for me, it's funny you say the Phoenix Lights, is the 1469, the German wood carvings. and the German media reports of was it Germany or was it it was Germany, I think.
There's all kinds of old UFO sightings. I have books on this, and it's weird.
Those things are weird. And even if it turns out to be like a supernova or two meteors colliding that outside by Mars, let's say, and it wasn't actually aliens, that's still fascinating.
Well, it's just...
You know, that's still an amazing event.
Some of the descriptions, though, are like very steampunky kind of descriptions of people trying to explain a flying craft that they would have no concept of. And that's crazy to me. I mean, that means something. They're describing these metal ships that they – it's not like we are used to seeing airplanes and other things in the sky and helicopters. But a lot of these – the descriptions of them are like if a person had never seen an airplane before – and now is trying to describe it.
Yeah.
They get this – it's not something that they would have been able to just put into context very easily.
And dinosaurs too.
Dinosaurs. I just went to the Cabazon dinosaur exhibit.
Yeah, but how have people seen dinosaurs before they knew what dinosaurs were? Like the Loch Ness Monster and Champ and Mokele and Mbembe in Africa. So, well, we'll have to revisit this another time. But it's always cool to talk. But these are great stories, and even if they're just fun campfire stories and stuff, like, you know, I think there's a whole wealth of information and some great scientific stuff out there that's really interesting. That you're right, that some of mainstream science should be looking at more.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's a whole history of it, whether it's true or not, and it's worth exploring.
And so, but how do you get the, like, do you take classes?
Yeah,
are you, like, writing theses and stuff?
I was. I mean, I had to take a break when I got the feature film because there was no way. Barbara Lamb was one of my teachers. I mean, there's just fascinating, respected people that have been studying this and have crazy, amazing stories. And they're also, you know, have real doctorates and are not just someone living out in the middle of nowhere. They're very smart, very interesting people that are helping alien abductee people with past or with hypnotic regression therapy. And I mean, there's a whole world out there that people don't think about on a regular basis.
And multiverse is actually pretty mainstream these days. That's not just ancient aliens, those guys. It's actually like a lot of quantum physicists are talking about this whole multiverse thing.
Yeah, we're very close to proving that it exists. And I was so excited when that new – the BioShock Infinite game dealt with the multiverse. And I mean, anything to get people thinking about it and wanting to find out what's actually going on, I think is really exciting.
Absolutely. So, well, our first outdoor episode and our first multiverse episode and our first editing episode, this has been just a great exploration of all – actually, we talked about all kinds of things people don't know about
in
this episode. Which I'm not surprised about. So anyway, Crystal House, thank you so much for taking the time out. I know it's been a crazy, crazy time for you, and we've been trying to schedule this forever. So I am so happy that we found an hour to sit down and talk about this more. I'm looking forward to talking to you again soon, whenever that may be. And if you guys want to talk more about Stand when it's released and hitting the festivals, please be in touch. We'll happily talk about the show and talk about the movie, and because I'm all about promoting independent movies, because I hate it when people say on Facebook, there's no good movies out there. There's tons of great movies out there.
We're trying.
Listen to the HDD Express. I'll find them all for you. All right, Crystal, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for listening, retweeting, downloading. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome TBD Express.